The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, earlier this year we thought we'd start a new family tradition. We flew down to Adelaide Oval, watched the Adelaide Crows play. And at first it was a lot of fun. We cheered them on, we booed the umpire, we booed Collingwood. But after a little while, it stopped being fun because Collingwood pulled ahead and they won by a big margin. And we thought, let's not do that again. Because it's no fun losing. We always want to pick the winners from the losers. When we choose where to work, we want to pick a growing sector, not a fading sector. When we choose where to invest, we want to pick a growing market, not a fading market. When it comes time to choosing our identity or our worldview, what do we want to be? Well, we certainly don't want to be a Christian, because right now Christianity is a joke. It's a Halloween costume, it's a punchline for late night comedians, and you end up being a punching bag on Q&A. So why would anyone want to be a Christian today? Just earlier this year, I had to see a doctor as an outpatient, and the doctor asked, what do I do for work? And I said to him, I'm a full-time professional Christian minister. And he went silent and a bit dark, and then he muttered, well, that explains the Bible verse on your t-shirt. And I went, yeah, I guess it does. And then a little bit later, he asked me, well, which Bible college did you go to? And I told him, and then I said to him, you seem to know a lot about Bible colleges. Are you a Christian? And he said, yes. And I asked him which church he went to, and he told me. So he's a full-time, church-attending, Bible-believing, committed Christian, and even he didn't know how to come out to me, a paid professional Christian minister, in public. And so our question is this: how do we navigate our post faith world? So welcome to Talk 3. We've been looking at how to survive, how to thrive, and how to navigate our post-faith world. We've looked at stories from the book of Daniel. Today we're looking at the story in Daniel chapter 6. It's a long story. We can't go through all of it. I'll just go through some points in the story. Hopefully we can take home that page and read the story for ourselves. But in this story, we meet Daniel. We meet him in verse 1. It pleased King Darius to appoint 120 satraps, and they were like mayors. So he appointed 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. Now, the satraps were made accountable to these administrators, Daniel, so that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in Daniel because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. We meet Daniel. Daniel's like that annoying junior upstart employee who's more gifted than you and now your job is threatened. Or maybe he's the loyal middle manager. He takes orders and he gives orders. Or maybe he's that Asian in your company, the model minority. He works hard and just stays out of trouble. Or maybe it's like this guy. He's worked hard, rises the ladder, but he hits the bamboo ceiling. He can only get so high because he doesn't have the old boys network. We meet Daniel, and he has enemies. They plot against him, and they find out why he prays every day in private. Let's pass a law that makes this illegal, and if he breaks his law, he gets thrown to the lions. What do we make of Daniel? Well, it's very important that we know what sort of story this is. Many years ago, I took my wife to see the premiere of the movie Scream. And halfway through it, I said to her, hey, this movie's terrible. The lines are cheesy. The acting's awful. It's not scary at all. I've already worked out who the killer is. Let's walk out. So we walked out. It's the only time I've ever walked out of a movie early. And the next day, the reviews came out and I read them. I thought, okay, this will be good. Let's see how they pan the movie. And the reviewers loved the movie. I thought, what is going on? And apparently I misread the genre of the movie. It was a comedy. I thought it was a horror movie. It was a parody of the horror genre, and I had mistook the genre. And the story of Daniel in the Lion's Den is the same. Is it a horror movie or is it a comedy? And I've learned a lot from my Old Testament lecturer, Kirk Paxton. He said that says there are enough clues here that this is actually a comedy, not a horror story in Daniel chapter 6. And the clues are this. The people who play politics, the story makes fun of them. It's a parody of people who play politics. Verse 6. So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and they said, "May King Darius live forever." The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce a decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Verse 11, then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. Verse 15, then these men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, "Remember, majesty, that according to the law, no decree or edict that the king issued can be changed." 120 men go everywhere, me, 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 as a group to the king, me, 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 to Daniel, me, 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 back to the king, me, 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 as a group. They're like minions, me, 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 or they're like a flock of sheep, or they're like school kids. Have you ever been to a primary school where the teachers do that clap, 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 and the kids go clap, 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 back? It's just so mind-numbing. It's mindless. Well, that's how these people who play politics are portrayed. Me, 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 me. Minions who go as a group. And then the story makes fun of the people in power. Verse 14. When the king heard this, the king was greatly distressed. Verse 15. Oh, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. Verse 18. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating, without any entertainment. He could not sleep. The king is powerless. I remember watching The Sopranos. I love The Sopranos because Tony Soprano, the head of the mafia in his town, he's so powerful. But at home, he was powerless. He couldn't control his teenage daughter. He couldn't control his mother. And he couldn't control his wife. At home, he had no power. It's like me. I had a spare room in my house and I had these visions of turning into a den, a man cave. But because I've got three little kids, this is what the room looks like. My kids have taken over my room. I'm powerless at home. And King Darius, the most powerful man of the superpower, the most powerful nation on earth, he finds himself powerless. Suddenly, there's politics. There are rules, and suddenly he finds he has no power. It's a comedy. So what can we learn from Daniel? Let me suggest six lessons we can learn from Daniel. Number one, and I've mentioned this before last year, but it's worth mentioning again. Number one, we exist in three spaces of freedom. We exist in three spaces of freedom. There's the private space, there's the freedom of assembly space, and there's the public space. So as I explained last year, in the privacy of my own home, I am a lactose intolerant Asian. I cannot drink milk and I can't eat cheese in the privacy of my own home. And 4 out of 5 Asians are lactose intolerant, which shows as a species of animal, we were never meant to drink from the milk of a cow. Then I can form a freedom of assembly. I can form a club for other lactose intolerant Asians. And we can be quite exclusive. If you want to eat dairy, fine, there's a club there for you. If you want to be Norwegian, fine, there's a club there for you. But this is an exclusive club for lactose intolerant Asians. But then in a public space, like in a high school cafeteria, I have to share this with people of all dietary persuasions, like dairy eaters, vegetarians, meat eaters, and lactose intolerant people. Here I have to be pluralistic and multi-dietary. In the privacy of my own home, we can say, okay, we watch AFL on Friday night. If you want to watch soccer, fine, go to the club down there. If you want to watch rugby, fine, go to the club down there. But in the privacy of our own home, we are AFL watchers on Friday night. Then in the freedom of assembly space, we can join an AFL team. If you want to play soccer, fine, there's a club out there for you. If you want to play frisbee, fine, there's a club there for you. But here we're quite exclusively AFL. But then in the public sphere, in a council park, we have to share this space with soccer players, rugby league players, frisbee players, and AFL players. In the privacy of my own home, I can declare Jesus is Lord. I can form a freedom of assembly, an association, a club, a church where other people believe Jesus is Lord. If you want to believe something else, fine. There are other clubs and associations out there for you. But in the public space, I have to share this with people, all tribes, traditions, cultures, faiths, and beliefs. We need freedom of conscience and freedom of religion in all these three spaces. And what's fascinating, in the last 3 weeks that we've looked at Daniel, all these three spaces have been threatened. So in Daniel chapter 1, which we looked at 3 weeks ago, where they were forced to learn from the Babylonians, their Jewish identity was threatened. And they were able to preserve that by maintaining their own diet and their own drinking regulations. Last week in Daniel 3, where they were forced to worship an image in public, this is where their freedom was threatened. But today in Daniel chapter 6, Daniel's told he can't pray in the privacy of his own home. So somehow we're seeing in Daniel how the freedom of conscience and freedom of religion is being threatened in these three spaces. Our second lesson we can learn from Daniel is this, and I mentioned this before last year, there's a spectrum of ways we can engage with our post-faith world. And I'm learning this from Andrew Cameron, who teaches ethics down in Canberra in his book Joined Up Life. When we engage our post-faith world, we have a spectrum of options. We can cooperate, I do as I'm told. I can subvert, I do as I'm told, but for different reasons. I whistle blow, I will call you out, or I can separate. Okay, I can't be here anymore. And you see how this might work if I'm a doctor in the public hospital. I cooperate, I do what you tell me to do. I can subvert, I do what you tell me to do, but for different reasons. I do it because I want to love the patient, but you might want to do it because you want to cut costs and cut waiting lists. I could whistle blow, hey, what you're doing here is unethical, you're cutting too many corners here. Or I can separate and say, okay, I can't work here anymore. I don't like who I've become. I've become too morally compromised. And you can see how this might work in our workspace. Let's say your corporation wants to say, hey, today's purple shirt day. We want all our employees to wear a purple shirt on purple shirt day. You might cooperate. I will wear a purple shirt because I too believe everyone should feel safe at work, free from bullying. We should be inclusive of all faith traditions and beliefs. You could subvert. You say, you know what? I will wear the purple shirt, but for different reasons. I'm wearing it because I think people of all faiths should be allowed to feel safe in this umbrella. You're doing it for other reasons. You could whistleblow and say, you know what? This isn't about inclusion or diversity or anti-bullying. This is about some ideology instead. Or you could separate and say, you know what? I can't work here anymore. So there's a spectrum of ways to engage. Number three, let your wisdom shine. No matter where we find ourselves, let our wisdom shine. Daniel chapter 6, verse 3. Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. We looked at this a few weeks ago. If we have the fear of the Lord, we have a wisdom that shines above all our peers because we will be in rhythm, in tune with the God and created this universe, and we'll be in rhythm and in tune with the world around us. And many years later, Jesus gives us this advice. In the book of Luke, chapter 21, verse 12, Jesus says, they will hand you over, and so you will bear testimony to me, but don't worry beforehand how you will defend yourselves, for I will give you words. So what will I say? Don't worry, I'll give you the words, and I will give you wisdom. You will have a way of life that just shines, that people say you have a better way of living. So live with wisdom. Fourth lesson from Daniel, be the calm, non-anxious presence. Whenever I go to parenting seminars, they say that as a parent, your role is to be the calm, non-anxious presence in your children's life. So the opposite would be to be the anxious presence. Oh my gosh, you spilt the milk. What have you done? Now we're all going to die. So that's the anxious presence. You could be the calm absence. Oh, whatever. That's their laissez-faire approach to parenting. Instead, the happy Goldilocks sweet spot is to be the calm, non-anxious presence. This is a teachable moment. Let's work through this together. And we see how Daniel is a calm, non-anxious presence. Everyone else is the anxious busyness, or the king is the anxious helplessness, but Daniel is a calm, non-anxious presence. Throughout the story, he is the one in control. And it helps us look forward to the time when Jesus himself will be on trial. And you notice Jesus, when he's on trial, he's a calm, non-anxious presence. He's the one in control. Lesson number 5. Work for the good of the country. No matter where we find ourselves, work for the good of our country. In one of the most astonishing verses, verse 21, after he's been thrown in the lion's den by the king, Daniel says, "Hey, may the king live forever." He blesses the king and wishes the best for the king. And we too wish the best for our country and work with our country. So one way of understanding it is this, and I'm getting this from Timothy Keller's book, Center Church. There's a spectrum of ways we can understand our world. We can understand our world as culture is good, or down the opposite end, we see culture is bad. Culture is good because of God's general grace, general revelation. There's goodness, truth, and beauty, no matter how foreign a culture feels to me. And culture is bad because of universal human depravity. There'll be some way of running away from God in every culture. So there's a spectrum of understanding our world that we find ourselves in. And then there's a spectrum of ways we can engage world. Now, at this end, you can say, you know what? I can't and I won't change this culture. It's irredeemable. I can't change it for good. Down this end of the spectrum is, you know what? I can. I can change this culture for good. It is redeemable. What other people see as a threat, I see as an opportunity for change and redemption. So putting these two spectrums together, we have 4 choices. So up in this quadrant, we see culture is good, but I can't and I won't change culture for good. This leads to a very strong sacred, secular divide. So in the privacy of my own home, I'll pray, I confess Jesus, Lord. But when I turn up to work, I'm in the public space and I'll just be a good doctor, a good lawyer, a good engineer. But there's a very strong private, public, sacred, secular divide operating here. Or we can go down this corner of the quadrant. You know, I can't change this culture for good. And this culture is bad, it's wicked, it's evil. Here we choose to separate. Withdraw. Maybe we can lead counter-cultural lives that are very attractive, that attract us to us, but really we abandon, we withdraw. And an example would be Daniel chapter 3, where Daniel's 3 friends refuse to bow down before the idol. So they separate, they withdraw from what culture is telling them to do. Then we can go up this end where culture is good and I can and I will change culture for good as well. Here we engage. We're relevant, we participate. And this is, I think, Daniel chapter 1, where they learnt from the teachers, they learnt from the philosophers of the Babylonians, and they outshone them in wisdom. And our final choice is this. And another example would be Joseph, who was prime minister in Egypt. I think he was doing the same thing. And our final corner will be, you know, culture is bad, but you know what? I can change it. It's not a threat. It's an opportunity for redemption. And here we participate. We become cultural producers, not just engaging, but we produce culture. And I think Daniel 6 might be an example. The story we read today, he still participates. He doesn't withdraw. And Queen Esther in Persia, and that famous line in the story of Esther, "For such a time as this, God might have placed you here." And for such a time, God has placed us here as well in 21st century Australia. All right, the 6th and final lesson then is this. Trust God's bigger story. No matter where we find ourselves, trust there's a bigger story going on. Verse 10, When Daniel learnt that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day, he prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he'd done before. As Christians, we often focus on how Daniel kept praying, but this verse wants us to realize he's not just praying, he's facing Jerusalem when he's praying. What is going on? I love how these days everyone has a big screen TV. You know, when I was a uni student and a junior doctor, we didn't have a big screen TV. We had a 30 centimeter old school TV. And if you wanted a big screen TV, you just sat up closer and that became your big screen TV. And I remember we'd invite 40 friends over to watch the State of Origin and we'd all be huddled around this little TV. And of course, you know, the problem with that is when you get up really close to one of these TVs, all you see are colored dots. You have to stand back if you want to see the big picture. And it's the same with Daniel. Right now in chapter 6, all we see are the colored dots, the chaos, the noise, the confusion. But if you just take a step back, you can see God's bigger picture. And that's what Daniel does by opening his windows and facing Jerusalem. Because he knows he's part of a bigger story going on, where God promises one day his people will return to Jerusalem. This is not the end of the story. And one day God's going to send his Messiah, the Son of God, to Jerusalem. And one day this Messiah will die on a cross just outside the gates of Jerusalem. And one day this Messiah will rise from the dead and God will be able to create a whole new people of God starting in Jerusalem, going to the ends of the earth. And so it's the same with us right now, 21st century, post-faith Australia. All we see is the noise, the chaos, the confusion. But if we just take a step back, we can see God's bigger picture. And it comes from the lips, astoundingly, of King Darius himself. In verse 26, King Darius says, "I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel." Well, why would I want to do that? Because he is the living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed and his dominion will never end. Kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall, but God's kingdom will never end. As I mentioned earlier, I've got three young boys, high energy, and I hate it when they go to someone's birthday party, a kid's birthday party, because they fill them up with sweets and they come back with a bag of sweets and they come back on that sugar high. But I know in 1 hour's time they will crash, because the sugar rush comes only to go. And kingdoms come only to go. Cultural trends come only to go. I'm not that old, but I've been old long enough to see the rise and fall of kingdoms. When I went to primary school, the UK was a superpower in this earth. We used to have a world map on our primary school classroom, and all the Commonwealth countries were coloured pink. Do you remember that? And they told us that the sun will never set on the British Empire. And then the USA became the next empire. And I knew that when I went to Europe. And you could, if you want to the map in Japanese, it had the Japanese flag on it. If you wanted the map in German, in the German language, it had the German flag on it. But if you wanted the English language map, it had the USA flag on it, not the English flag anymore. And even now, because I still follow the USA politics and media, even the US media is now predicting the fall of the US empire and the rise of another empire. Empires come, empires go, but only one kingdom will be here forever. And God says in Daniel, no matter where we find ourselves, work for the good of this country and let your wisdom shine. But just remember that our citizenship is in heaven and that kingdom will last forever.
Why did Darius feel powerless when he was without question an absolute ruler? Why does he feel powerless?
I think that is fascinating. So it all comes down to the whole theory of government, doesn't it? Like, what is the role of kings? What is the role of courts and judges? What is the role of law? What is the role of police? What is the role of army? And we always know there's checks and balances. Whenever one of these things exist, one of these arms exists without checks and balances, you end up with a military coup or a dictator or something else. But it even seems for these superpowers to be sustainable, there had to be checks and balances. Like, no one person can have ultimate power.
Okay. All right. Another question here. Does the Chinese government's call for Andrew Hastie to repent, in inverted commas, indicate an intention to remove the private space freedom of believers?
Yeah, and it's fascinating because there was a similar question that I was just reading through. Does private, public, sacred, secular sort of only make sense in our Western constructs? Because in many other cultures, there's no such thing as private versus public, sacred versus secular. And I think, yeah, to a degree, largely. So I'm sort of appropriating a lot of the story and trying to make sense for what it is for us today in our Western world. But for a lot of people, this whole private public thing isn't so strong. And we really, really notice that. Like, if we said, hey, let's have a prayer meeting out there on the street or a Martin place, none of us, no. I'm happy to keep my prayer life in the privacy of my own home. But if you go to an Asian news agency or an Asian restaurant, they have temples and shrines set up. So they don't have that strict public-private divide. Yeah. So I guess for us then, Oz Guinness has this amazing book right now on the crisis of freedom. And he says the best way of understanding the freedom of religion is to phrase it in terms of freedom of conscience. It's not just freedom to worship, but freedom to believe, think, imagine, and a freedom of conscience. And I think that's what's under threat here. So not so much what I do even in the privacy of my bedroom, because in these totalitarian regimes like China and King Darius, they feel like they own even that space. But can they touch this space in here, my freedom of conscience?
Okay, thank you, Sam. Do we have any evidence outside the Bible of the laws of the Medes and Persians not being able to be changed?
That's a bit of an archaeological question for you.
Oh, yeah, I can't answer at that specific evidential level. But I think, again, going back to the whole, I'm always struck by how every culture, every nation finds that whole checks and balances between, you know, whoever's in power, the court system, and also the military. And it struck me when I watched Vikings, that show on SBS, where even there you could see the three arms of governance and how they all need their checks and balances. And instead, one person tries to have total control. And we've seen that right now with Donald Trump in the USA, where he seems to think he can tweet and get around the court system. Now we have this whole impeachment thing going on. Again, even the president of the USA, there are checks and balances to his power.
Okay. All right, this is the last question, and it's kind of like three questions. This is the one that you were dreading. I'll read it all. Would secular or private make any sense in Babylon? Part one. Part two. They only make sense if the Babylonian king isn't divine and all-powerful. And part three, so is Daniel a subversive comedy?
Yeah, so number one, again, the whole public-private, I think I answered that earlier. Number two, King Darius, we're seeing that the limits is he can't rule my freedom of conscience. I think that's what we're seeing there. So he might be able to rule what I do in the privacy of my own home, in my bedroom, but he can't rule what I believe in my heart of hearts. And number three, yes, I think it is a subversive comedy, and that's how a lot of politics happens, through satire and subversive comedy and parody. And I think that's what we're seeing there.
Okay, just last, can I ask you one
sure
other question? Can I put you on the spot?
Yeah.
As a doctor, so you're in that whole medical world.
Yeah.
What would cause you to give up your job as a doctor when there's so much pressure? What would it be for you? What would be the tipping point?
I think,
because I know a lot of doctors are under a lot of pressure at the moment. Yeah.
I think the instant you lose your freedom of conscience, where you're asked to act against your conscience. And I remember my PhD supervisor, Graham Cole, saying, the instant you look in the mirror and you say, I don't like the person I've become.
Thank you so much for your honesty.
And it's interesting, the military right now, they've created this whole new category called moral injury. And so there's this dissonance between what I believe and what I'm doing, and it's a new form of PTSD, but it's moral injury, where I've had to see and do things that in my heart of hearts I don't believe, and I don't like who I've become.
Yeah. Thank you. Sure. Thanks so much, Sam. Please join me.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.